Hello, all you positive heads out there. It's so good to be back with all you beautiful reflections of the one source consciousness that creates and animates all things. If you're new to this podcast, of course, we're super happy to have you here. And if you've been listening and enjoying for a while, I would be super grateful if you would please take a moment to give us a review on Apple Podcasts. It's one of the best and simplest ways to pay it forward and help others find the show so that they too can tap into the powerful perspectives and positive vibrations we are collectively emanating. The other unique and magical way to share this show is by sending any friends you think would benefit from listening to this podcast our Game with the Universe link at positivehead.com/game. Also listed in the show notes, which will serve them up a quote-unquote random episode when they click it. Just instruct them before clicking the link to close their eyes for a moment and sincerely ask the universe to cue up the episode that contains the insight and perspectives that they most need to hear at this point in their life journey, and then click to listen to whatever episode is synchronistically served up to them. I have heard time and time again from people about the incredible results they received playing the game. So just tell your friends, magical results are guaranteed or their karma back. All right, all you positive heads. On this week's Soul Share episode, I'm very excited to have Mary Morrissey here with me on the show. Mary is an author, empowerment specialist, and founder of the Brave Thinking Institute, who has spent the last 40 years helping people to build their dreams by becoming brave thinkers. Hello, Mary. Welcome to the show, my friend.
Hi, Brandon. So nice to be here.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. We got to drop in for longer than normal, than typical before we began. And so I'm extra excited now because I know how amazing you are and that this is going to be a really excellent episode. And with that being said, I would like to start with my cliche opening question for you. And it is this. You're in an elevator. The woman next to you looks over, says, "What's your passion?" You got 10 floors to answer. What do you say?
I say to her, "My passion is helping invoke the greatest dream that an individual has and then showing them a simple art and science for making that dream come true."
Ooh, I like that. Simple art and science. Well, let's talk about how you got there and then, of course, what that looks like. If you would, I always like to kind of begin with whatever feels relevant, with your backstory. Okay. And I know with you, some stuff happened in high school that really kicked you off on this path. And so I'd love to just hear whatever you feel. Yeah, whatever's relevant to share.
I think as many of your listeners will know that sometimes the thing that seems the worst in the moment turns out to be the best when more information is given that we make use of. So my particular journey, I had a wonderful family I was raised in. My sister, 8 years older, mom and dad loved each other their whole life. So I had a great upbringing and a terrific high school experience. And in fact, like most young girls would dream about it. At the end of my junior year in high school, I'm class vice president. I'm on the drill team. I have a lead in the junior play. I'm homecoming princess.
Wow.
And
if you could please overachieve for me, that'd be great.
My high school boyfriend, who had gone off to college, came home on spring break. I got pregnant. May 1, I'm telling my mom and dad I am now pregnant.
Wow.
This is 1966. My mother wept for me as if I had died. We had a very hasty 10-person wedding, and a couple of weeks later, mid-May now, the principal called me to his office and said, "Are these rumors I'm hearing about you true?" And I said, "Well, if the rumors are that I'm pregnant and married in that order, then yes, they're true."
Wow.
And he just put his head in his hands and he said, "Mary, you have great academics and terrific honors, but you will not be allowed to return here for your senior year in high school. It would be totally inappropriate for a pregnant girl to get mixed in with the normal girls. But we have a place for people like you if you want to get a high school diploma." Well, my dream had been to go to college and become a teacher. So I did want a high school diploma. So he said, "So it's held at Washington High School, not during the day. It becomes Washington Evening High School at night for pregnant girls and delinquent boys." Now, this high school was across the river in Portland, Oregon, in North Portland, in a place actually I hadn't been allowed to drive in after dark.
Wow.
And so that next fall, I drove across there. And as I'm walking up these steps, and by then, you know, everybody knows I'm pregnant. This whole thing is, I'm cast out of the school. My best girlfriends I'd grown up with since I was in fourth grade, there were four of us, were best friends. Those mothers got together and decided their girls could no longer see me.
Wow.
So I lost my friends, my school, my student body. And I'm walking up these steps thinking, all right, every girl here is either pregnant, every guy is some kind of delinquent. This is my new student body.
Yeah.
My son was born in December. I graduated from Washington Evening High School in May, and in July, I'm in an intensive care ward in a Portland hospital, having been diagnosed with fatal kidney disease.
Wow.
One kidney was totally destroyed with nephritis, kidney disease. The other had 50% destruction, active nephritis. This is pre-transplant or dialysis. This is a death sentence in 1967.
Wow.
And they're very, very sorry, but there is, quote unquote, no hope for me. And then they decided that if they could get the blood toxin level in my body reduced enough for me to simply survive the surgery to remove the right kidney and get that toxicity out of my system, maybe I would have 6 months to live before the other kidney, you know, completely lost function. They didn't know how long it would last with 50% destruction anyway. So finally, the night before the surgery was scheduled, a woman walked in my room. Now, I was raised, you know, Brandon, the God of my upbringing was not a friendly place to go if you felt like you really screwed up.
Yeah.
You know, it was a God with a personality, angry, punishing.
Sounds familiar to me.
Yeah. So I just thought I'm being punished for being a bad girl. Clearly, I'm a bad girl. I go to school with delinquents. My best girlfriends can't talk to me. I'm kicked out of high school. I'm a bad girl.
Wow.
And it wasn't like conscious, but it was going on in me.
Yeah.
And I'm not aware of it at this point. But a woman walks in my bedroom or the hospital intensive care room that night and says, I'm a chaplain. I come here several nights a week. I'm given and she showed me the piece of paper with a list of those who are having surgery the next day in order of the most seriousness. Mary, your name's at the top of the list.
Wow.
And she said, would you like someone to pray with you? And I was scared and I said, okay. She pulled her chair next, you know, at this point, I'm thinking, I'm never going to see, maybe I'll see my little boy walk. I'll never see him go to kindergarten. I mean, this is just,
wow.
I'm heartbroken. And she pulls her chair next to my bed and does nothing that looks like or sounds like anything I've ever been trained is quote unquote prayer. She starts to talk to me and she said, would you be willing to tell me what's been going on in your life the last year or two? So I told her my story, at the end of which, Brendan, she looked at me compassionately and she said, Mary, everything's created twice. There's like, went right over my head. Today I would say I had no landing page for that. It's like, what do you mean? And she says, well, actually, you know this. In fact, everybody knows this. Almost no one knows the power of knowing this. And then she said, the bed you're laying on, the nightgown you're wearing, the sheet covering in the walls, the ceiling, the floors, all this machinery you're hooked up to, first it had to be a thought before it could be a thing. Mm. Everything is created twice. And now that you're considering how everything is created twice, I hear how much in your story you love your little boy, but I hear also how much you've been hating yourself.
Mm.
You feel like you shamed your school, you shamed your family, you shamed yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And now that you're considering how everything is created twice, could you just consider the possibility that there could be a correlation between that toxic thinking and the toxicity that is rampaging your body and threatening your life?
Wow.
This is 1967, the summer of 67. Nobody I know.
Yeah.
Nobody I know thinks
talks
this
like
way.
That,
and
yeah.
This is, well, and it's before the Mind-Body Clinic at Harvard and Stanford and UCLA and all around the U.S. and the medical schools now, the Mind-Body Clinics. This was, we didn't have any idea of the power of emotional and physical connectedness. So then she says, so if you could live, what would you do? And I said, I knew immediately I would raise my little boy and I'd become a teacher. She said, so, okay, so let me, and then she asked me, she said, could you believe that we can do a prayer together? Or she used the word visualization. I didn't know what it meant then. And in the morning, the doctors could come in and say, oh my gosh, you look so much better. We better test you. And they test you. And they say, we can't find any trace of disease. Wow. I mean, get up, go home. Could you believe that? And I told her the truth. No.
Yeah.
There wasn't one part of me that was going to believe that she was going to say some words. I believe way more in my pain at this point than her possibility. And she said, okay, so if you can't believe that's possible, then I want you to remember there are infinite possibilities.
Yeah.
The one you agree with is the one you are most likely to manifest. So could there be a possibility that we do these words and you do the process I'm about to give you, and instead of getting worse after the surgery, you start to get better, and you get better and better and better, and you get well. Could you believe that's possible? Now, I didn't believe it, but I could. It's the first time that's ever happened in my life.
Could imagine what it'd be like.
No, it was actually, I could tell she believed it.
Right.
She believed it. And I borrowed her belief enough to say, I guess it's a possibility.
What a gift.
And this is before Talbot wrote Holographic Universe or Sheldrake did quantum field theory. This is way before that kind of understanding that was in the general populace.
Right.
And so she said, okay, so then she said, here's what I want you to do. When you come back from surgery for the first 2 or 3 days, your mind is going to be busy with the pain and just getting over the surgery. But as that pain starts to ebb, your mind is going to want to go down the well-worn paths of thinking that you've been doing for the last almost 2 years now.
Mm-hmm.
So here's what I want you to do. Every time you notice a self-loathing thought, mm-hmm. interrupt it and say, no, that, because here's what we're going to do. This visualization, we're going to take all the toxicity and place it in the one kidney. And when it's removed, that toxicity, the shame, we're removing that too. So when your mind wants to think shame again or self-loathing, when it comes to mind, say, no, that left with the kidney, then immediately replace that with imagining that you're walking up some steps into an elementary school and you have a warm little boy's hand in yours and feel that. And he's 5 years old and it's your boy and you're walking and he's so happy to get to go to kindergarten. You give him a big hug and he goes into kindergarten and then you hear the click, click, click of your heels as you go down the hall and around the corner and there's your classroom. Then fast forward in your mind and you're sitting in a stadium or a big auditorium and down on the floor are all these caps and gowns. You hear your son's name called. He comes up on the stage, gets his diploma in his hand, raises his hands. You're cheering in the stands for all the many moments you've been there to support him in achieving this goal in his life. And your teaching career is growing. Then fast forward and you're sitting in the front row of a wedding. It's your son's wedding. Wow. You're the mother of the groom. He's marrying the love of his life and your teaching career is flourishing. Just keep doing that. I was evidently what we would call an unconscious competent, which is doing the thing, but not aware of it. They did the surgery. I can't tell you that I was smart enough or aware enough to think, oh, if I do this process, it's going to help me. I just did it. And after about 10 days after this, the doctors told my family when they were gathered that one kidney, he says, I don't even know if she'll have 3 months. He said, it's withered and popular.
Oh, wow. And the one that was not getting taken out.
Exactly. But then after about 10 to 14 days, my numbers started to stabilize. And they said, well, you may be going to get a little more time than we thought. And you're as long as you're stable right now, if you go into the urologist 3 times a week to test your numbers, and you want to go home, we'll let you go home. They sent me home in an ambulance. I couldn't get my head off the pillow. I was so weak and still very, very sick. Got home. And then my numbers just stabilized and then just slightly started to improve and improve and improve. About 5.5 months after that surgery, I'm sitting in a conference room at the hospital, same hospital, the same doctors, the surgeon, and they're scratching their heads and they're saying, and I am too. We have no science for what's happened with you. And the surgeon said, I saw that kidney. He said, there's no functional way it could be doing what it's doing right now. But right now it's performing as a perfectly fine kidney.
Wow.
We don't know how long this will last, if it'll last, but whatever you're doing, keep doing it. I didn't even know what I was doing. And I just got better and better. I got well. And I was happy about that, but I wasn't yet curious. about really how that occurred until several years later. It was probably 3 years later, I finally got myself into full-time academic work in a university. And a series of things occurred. I know, Brendan, we talked earlier about things that have occurred in your life that are you realize this is not just a coincidence.
Right.
It looks like coincidence, but there are too many of these things occurring at once for me to not pay attention.
Right.
And that's where I began, without going into all the story of what it was, that introduced me into a new level of I am highly interested in how real transformation, how you move one set of results to another set of results. How does that really occur?
Mm.
And who do we have to be and what do we have to do in order to bring that kind of transformation into results in our lives that might be a health thing we want to transform or a relationship or money or any other thing? Because all of those are effects of what's really going on inside of us. And how do we change that? And that began a study. I studied for a decade, studying everything I could find in the field of transformation, from studying all the world's religions, philosophies, getting many different kinds of degrees, getting a master's in counseling psychology, studying the new emerging physics, and just highly interested. That led me down an amazing path over many years. Within a very short time, I knew, yes, I wanted to be a teacher, but what I really want to teach is this.
Mm. Wow. What a journey. That is so inspiring. And, I wonder, once you started to improve, were you sort of in shock? I mean, you had prepared to die at what age were you? You're like 18?
I was 18.
Wow.
No, I was 18.
You're just a baby.
My son was born in December and I was still 17.
Wow.
So I wouldn't say I was in shock. I'm too immature.
Yeah.
I'm immature spiritually. I'm immature in every way.
Mm.
It was just, oh, good.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I'm just happy. And now I'm raising my little boy and I'm, being a young housewife and thinking about my future and our future and planning to which college to go to. And that was that level of awareness.
Yeah.
But then 3 years later, when I got into the university and three things, as I mentioned, occurred, I went, oh, this did not happen to me. This happened with me,
mm-hmm.
both the dis-ease and the healing.
Yeah.
And then I began, over the many years of study, 10 before I started ever teaching it to anybody else, was realizing there's not one thing, no matter how long it's been there. Sometimes people believe because I've had this chronic condition for 10 years. Over the years of the work I've done and done with people, you can't do it for them, but you can show them how to do it,
mm-hmm.
And be with them and support them in the process. I mean, I've seen all kinds of things, including chronic immune disorders and things that regular physicians have been trained. This is incurable.
Yep.
And so we medicate for that. But that's one path. It's not the only path. And it doesn't mean no matter how long it's been there, it can't be changed. You have all kinds of embryonic cells in every single body, and those can be activated.
Yeah.
And a number of ways to do it long before we were doing anything called stem cell treatments.
Right.
I've been doing this a long time.
Right. Wow.
But notice what she gave me. She asked me what my vision was. Wanting to get well is not a big enough goal.
Mm-hmm.
Health is for the purpose of something.
Mm-hmm.
What if you could live?
What would you do with your life?
So we created a vision for Mary.
Mm-hmm.
I would raise my little boy. I would become a teacher. And if that occurs, then this is going to happen, and this is going to happen, and this is going to happen. And I began, over the years of reflection and study and studying transformation, to realize the primary beginning of transformation is to have a vision.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, why I ask you, what is your vision?
Right.
To have a vision of what it is that the next stage of expressed life looks like for you.
Right. And it kind of comes back to something that I actually talked about on yesterday's episode, which is, trajectory beats position, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah, nice, it really line. Is. It's really a really great line. I had just heard it the day before. I was at a friend's gathering and someone got up and gave sort of an inspirational speech. And he said, you know, trajectory beats position 10 out of 10 times. And then he went on to explain it. I'm like, wow, what a great statement, right? And so it's really cool now today, the next day after recording that, to hear the perfect example story for that, right? Wow. So, you know, you went on to, lucky for all of us, you hear all these many decades later, and you've spent, you know, 40 plus years teaching and helping people to dream build, as you put it. And, you know,
mm-hmm. lots of people dream, but very few people know the art and science of dream building.
Yeah. What can you speak to that? And, yeah, please.
Yeah. Yeah. The art is in the vision. And not just I hope someday. It's a vision that you step into as I'm walking my little boy into kindergarten. I'm holding, there's a whole relationship with the vision. So we call it, you know, a calibration of vision. And there's, if you think about it right now, every one of us, and you can look in your own life right now and see this, you have results in four major areas of life happening right now. These are my results. Those are your results. Results in your health. We can measure your health right now, your blood pressure, your weight, your blood. I mean, we can measure all kinds of things and give you a health report. Those are your health results that are current. You have relationship results. How much fulfillment, how much depth, how much connection. You can measure your current relationship results. Some people carry a lot of resentment and carry a lot of disruption in their lives. Others have way more harmony, and those are results. So if you're in love with the results, then that's an area of life that you're thriving in. But you have health, relationships, vocation. Now, that doesn't mean you're earning income doing it. Most likely it is for most of us, but it's what we're doing with our time and talent. Everybody does something with their time and talent, including sitting watching TV. That's what they do with their time and talent. What is it fulfilling? Is it meaningful? Do you have meaning and purpose in it? Does it wake you up in the morning to, you know, live into this next day, bring your own expression of what's your vocare, what comes through you? And every one of us have current results in our vocation. And the other is the freedom quadrant. How much freedom, how much time freedom, how much money freedom do you have in your life? Nobody wants stacks of money inside their office, just looking at stacks of money, but you do want what it'll do if you pour it into things that matter to you, including your philanthropy. The freedom quadrant is that spirit, I believe, It is seeking greater and greater expression of itself by means of itself. So life, call it spirit, call it God, call it life. It's this sacred energy that is the very energy that's beating each one of our hearts. Not one of us created ourselves. We didn't create ourselves, nor do we have the personal power to even make our heart beat one time. We're being animated by this living energy that's pouring into and through us, ever seeking a greater expression, not just of us, but it's pressing through a blade of grass today to be a better blade of grass. It's pressing through the edges of the tree to become more of itself as a tree, and it's pressing in you and me to become more potentiated, more expressed in the areas that matter to us. And as much as you have a thumbprint, you have a soul print about what really brings life into its fullness but through the activation of you coming into harmony with and expressing it. Now, none of us are really trained in this, or I shouldn't say none of us, almost none of us are. So how do you know what is your vision? One of the things over many, many years of doing trainings with people, I'd say about 50% of the people in my small events and in my very, very large thousands of people events, about 50% of the people will say, I don't know my dream. I don't know what my dream is. And they believe that's true. Actually, they do know, but it's not in their level of awareness, because they've been trained to so much deal with what's coming at them that they haven't been trained in how to listen to what's seeking to come mm-hmm. through them and by means of them. And so that's the first level of support. And so we go through in the Dream Builder event I do, that's the first stage. Is day one is the blueprinting day, where you create a blueprint, and there's a process that we go through. And by the end of the day, people are just, oh my gosh, I really would love this. We start, there's two signals your soul sends you of the right path. One is longing. If you just listen to yourself, the kind of inner pulse, at times you'll hear longing. Like, I would just love it if I could, and it can be simple, if I could take all my grandchildren mm-hmm. and go do this, or if I could create this business, I would just love it if there's a feeling of longing, that mm-hmm. spirit in you, sending you a signal of possibility. The other is discontent. Oh, I'm so tired of struggling with money at the end of the month. That weighted, those are both very positive spiritual energies, but not if we don't pay attention to them. Because life is going to express that river of life coming into us. None of us are strong enough to stop it. If we don't give it a positive expression, then you begin to see signs and signals of unlived life that show up as problems and difficulties. And because we're not giving it a vision to pour itself into that is life-giving. So the vision, you pay attention to longing and discontent, and you begin to track that, and then you follow that up with a question. And the question is, all right, in the presence of this longing and this discontent, what would I love? What would I love that would answer the longing and dissolve mm-hmm. the discontent? And then we begin to shape that into a vision. And the important part of shaping a vision is that you have to get how it's going to occur off the table of your thinking. And
that's such a barrier for so many people, right? They get caught in the logic.
Well, sure, but they don't know they can do that. Yeah. And here's the deal. Most of us have not been trained to think, what would I love? We've been trained to think, what do I think mm-hmm. I can do, given my conditions, given my history, my education? And we bring all those conditions to the table as if those conditions are powerful. They're no more powerful than the belief mm-hmm. we place in them. I mean, there's countless stories of people who had all kinds of conditions and blew right past them. So it's not the conditions that hold us back. It's the belief about those conditions that actually holds us back. So what would I love? That shapes the vision. That's step one, is creating a very compelling, life-giving vision for what it is you would really love. And I encourage people to cast a 3-year vision, not a 1-year vision. Mm. I'll tell you why. Because my work with people over years, psychologically, when I say, I want to have really what I would love and really what I would answer my longing to solve my discontent. And then I say, I'm going to do that in a year. It's very challenging for many of us to believe that we can accomplish that in a year. We start thinking more about, because the subconscious immediately knows what we've accomplished in a year.
It's so short. But it's when easy.
That's right. When we say 3 years or sooner, and it can always happen sooner, but 3 years or sooner, the subconscious doesn't know just in fact what you might get done in 3 years. And so it's way more malleable to allow you in this inner ground to plant some new seeds and foster them and grow them. So the longing and discontent is an important key to answering the question, what would I love? And that's very, very powerful when you answer that.
Yeah, I love that. And, you know, I'm curious what your thoughts are. You know, you set your vision, you're doing sort of the right things pertaining to stepping into this version of yourself, and then attachment to expectation comes in, right? And then it's, okay, maybe it's things aren't unfolding the way I visioned, and now I'm created more discontent because I'm attached to this idea. And so I'm curious what your thoughts are when that happens.
It's a great question. We start by telling people, first of all, you know, more people spend more time planning a weekend trip than they spend planning their life.
That's funny.
So we cast the vision. Then, yes, then you begin to manage. You learn to think. This is why we call it brave thinking, where you're vision-driven thinking versus condition-based thinking. We have been trained to think from conditions. So when I was beginning my first work, in the days when I wanted to start teaching in the 70s, the only path I saw to teach transformation in that time was by becoming a minister, a very ecumenical, open-minded, welcoming to all faiths work. And it grew very, very slow. I was doing therapy all week long to earn my part of the income for our family so I could then rent this little place, an Oddfellows Hall in Beaverton, Oregon. And, you know, we were learning how to create an event and do these things. But this was a very old place, and we made an agreement with the Oddfellows people. They wanted $25 a week use the space. But if I would come in, we would come in and clean the space, clean up the kitchen and the bathrooms from the night before. I scrubbed toilets. Wow. I cleaned that kitchen. And I mean, this was pouring myself into this. And it you know, started very, well, there were 22 people who came the first time. The next week, there were eight because the first thing, they came to help me get lunch and friends, family. And it grew from there. But after about, when it got to about 40 to 50 people, it just stayed there. And I didn't know how to grow it beyond that. And it took me about a year and a half to get there. And it was a wonderful group of people. And I was grateful for that group of people to get to work with. And I kept thinking, you know, there's only metal chairs to sit in. There's linoleum that's curling up on the edges of the room. And we don't have money for advertising. And then along the way, I met who would become my mentor, a man named Jack Boland. And I was telling him, I said, he had a very successful work in Detroit, Michigan area in Warren, and TV all over the Northeast and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people coming on the weekends. And I said to him, I want to do what you're not exactly what you're doing. I want to do my version of that on the West Coast. And he said, well, I can help you with that. But it's going to cost you. And I said, what do you mean it's going to cost me? And he said, I said, well, how much? And he said, oh, that's your problem. You think, he said, you think that how much something costs has something to do with what you want. And I went, yeah, actually, I do think that. In fact, everybody I know thinks that.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm telling you, that's your problem. Get clear on what you want. Don't put how much it's going to cost on determining whether or not you can have it. And when he says, so what do you think's in your way? And I told him about the linoleum and the chairs. And he says, that's not what's in your way. He says, I can promise you can fill that place to waiting lines with it being exactly the way it is, but you got to change. This is not about linoleum. This is about your belief in linoleum. We need to get that shifted.
Yep.
And I decided to work. I found a way to get the deposit. And he said, you got to come to Detroit next week, which I didn't think I could, but I was in Chicago at this point. I said, okay. So I went, and he said, I'm going to mentor three people. I have two men picked out, and I have been thinking there should be a woman. And I believe you're that person. So I jumped in and got to Detroit. I'm in a room waiting with two guys. And then he comes in and he introduces us. Mary Morrissey, this is Les Brown. This is Wayne Dyer.
Oh, wow.
And the three of us got mentored together. This started in the 80s.
Wow.
And we became, of course, 40 years of friendship. Lots of programs together that have gone on and on and on. You know, we're on speed dial with each other until Wayne passed away, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But this system, you know, over time I began to see it's invisible to most people, but there is a system of transformation that works every single time in the same way that every place on our planet where electricity works is wired to code. The potential for light is everywhere, but in order to work with the invisible laws that govern the flow of the electrons and the molecules that produce illumination, has to be done to code. Once the code is discovered, you can apply it to any building. It can be a one-room shack. It can be a cathedral. And the same thing with bringing transformation into our lives. It starts with a vision. That's the art. But the science is in the vibration.
Yeah. It makes me think of something that I always say. And it's that, you know, we all have such varying stories and paths, you know, that our life, you know, takes us on this winding, unique journey. And I think the number one job that we all have on that journey is managing our vibration. Mm-hmm. It's like that is when people, what should I do? Where we manage your vibration? That is the job, you know, and everything stemming from there. And it's so easy to get caught up in out, you know, there is no out there. It's showing up as a reflection of you, right? Your internal state. And so, you know, that's
but
the most.
But how you match the part of what I believe is important for us. Mm-hmm. Is once you have a vision, mm-hmm. there's a vibration that's an exact, in the same way a URL is an exact match to something that you can, you don't get to see what's on that website if you don't match the exact URL.
Right.
It's the same thing. You don't get to see those results in your life unless you are an exact match. Mm. How do you do that?
Mm-hmm.
That's phase two of dream building,
mm-hmm.
which we call bridging. So you bridge from the dominant vibration you've been on, which has produced the results you've got.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to have different results, you're right. We got to change what's the dominant vibration of our own thinking, feeling, and act. And all of that comes together. And it's way simpler than I think most of us feel like, even to use the word manage, like it's something that's an act of willpower mm-hmm. or something. It's actually I obviously, Brendan, you do this in highly successful ways. When I just listen to the many different things you already have accomplished, are accomplishing, and plan to accomplish, you've got this.
Mm-hmm.
So, and thank you for doing this work in the world that you do.
Mm.
And the
thank
impact of that.
So.
Well, yes. You know, I'm part of the recipiency of that today.
Well, you know, definitely a reflection, and it's interesting sort of hearing your journey, which led you to Wayne Dyer, who, you know, working alongside or training alongside Wayne Dyer, who's one of my favorite, you know, teachers in my own life. And I feel such a resonance with his just energy and vibration. And it's really beautiful to hear about your journey creating these gatherings, which, you know, like you said, back then it was like sort of church-centric was the only path almost. And I even shared with you prior to this, starting to do Sunday gatherings as a part of my, what's your vision? You asked me before we start recording. Well, I'm going to start doing some Sunday gatherings, you know? And so it's like, oh, wow, you've been there, done that, and gotten the t-shirt, you know? And so it's really inspiring. And I want to ask more about what you just said. You know, you pinged on me using the word manage as if like, oh, it almost sounds like a job or work mm-hmm. a little bit. And so, could you just, for my own sake and the audience, like, you know, could you just elaborate a little bit on what you're getting at there?
Well, in the once you have the vision,
mm-hmm.
and so notice what happened for Mary in the story I shared with you.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm spending my day thinking, I'm a bad girl. I shame myself. I've shamed my family. I've shamed my school. My girlfriends won't talk to me. They think I'm a bad person. Notice the vibration that mm-hmm. that thinking produces, right? So then the training part, which is what we do specifically on day two at the Dream Builder event that we do, is train people in how actually to apply your pattern to the vibration that matches the vision you're holding. And it's just a process, but once you employ it, so she says, Mary, do this. Now think, instead of thinking what you've been thinking, as soon as you notice a self-loathing thought, well, guess what the tool was I had to learn right there? To notice.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody was noticing. I was just letting whatever thoughts came my way think me, Many of those were driven by toxic emotion. You know, once you learn to notice what you're noticing, that's the number one life mastery tool, is to notice what you're noticing, because those thoughts have a pattern to them and have a vibration to them. And they're going to take you upward or they're going to take you downward. Everything is either expanding or contracting,
right?
Including the direction of our lives. So how we then match our dominant pattern of vibration to the vision, that's a simple process that just requires some training.
Yeah.
Once you begin to learn that, the amount of time required to produce the result you want has everything to do with the match of the vibration.
Mm-hmm.
People say, well, how long is this going to take? However long it takes for you to become a full match. That's all it is. Think about your television right now. All of us, most of us, if we, whether you watch streaming or you watch cable, or there's thousands, if not millions, of options at any moment. But the way you get to your option of what's going to be the picture on your screen, you got this remote control thing that dictates the vibration you're tuned to, or the frequency that you're tuned to.
Yeah.
And you get an exact match to the frequency you're tuned to. So the results we currently have are an exact match to the frequency we're tuned to. And they show up in health and relationships and vocation, how much love we can allow in our lives before we shut it down, find something wrong with the other person, and versus making, learning what it means to love fully and be loved fully in this brief moment called our human birth, and making that a high priority, or learning that highly, highly successful people are willing to be uncomfortable in the interest of growth. They don't want to just be uncomfortable. Yeah. But those of us who have gathered some success under our belts, we're willing and are willing to be uncomfortable because we value growth over comfort. Some people value comfort over growth.
Yeah.
So what you make important will be important. It'll show up.
Amazing, amazing. So I would, you know, as we sort of start to wind down a little bit here, I would like to switch gears just a little bit. I love, as the listeners know, I love story time. I love to hear a good story of synchronicity or serendipity, a positive paranormal story. And just wondering if you have something like that up your sleeve to share.
Oh, many, like you, many, many.
How much time do I got?
Here's one. You know, along the way of the journey of, does this really work on all things? As a student of transformation and those who were exhibiting, you know, world-changing transformation, and can you dream up anything? These were questions that were in those days really going on in me, and how does the physics of this work? And I'd read a book and I'd attended a speech by His Holiness the Dalai Lama in Portland, Oregon. And there were like 30,000 people. I'm way up in the nosebleed seats. I'm a minister of a small work. This is during my 23 years as a minister, long before I got into a much wider work with the work I'm doing these days. But I'm listening to, now I know the story of Tibet and how the Chinese government has sought systematically to completely stamp out a 5,000-year-old tradition on our planet. And in fact, if someone even today in Tibet were to say out loud Om Mani Padme Hum, which is effectively if you said Our Father who art in heaven, or Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one, and it's spoken out loud, not only that person but their whole family is incarcerated for life. That's the punishment. And so they take him out to save his life at 14, and he's worked diligently for the freedom of Tibet. And this kind of thing goes on and on and on in Tibet, destroying their temples. I mean, on and on. And yet when he's speaking, I couldn't hear one wavelength of resentment or bitterness.
Yeah.
None of that. And I thought, how does he do that? And I thought, I want to be able to ask that man this question.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, clearly there's something he knows. I want to know that. And so I just started imagining I thought, okay, so I'm going to apply this. So I started imagining sitting in his, I didn't know if it was would be a temple or if it what it was going to be, but it was where he was, and we were sitting having a cup of tea together, and he says, do you have any questions of me? And I could ask my question. And I just every so often would weave that experience where I'm sitting with him having the tea, asking the question. And then, and now I have a small ministry, nothing, there's absolutely no thing in the world of conditions that would say that's going to happen. But I'm imagining it. Now, this went on for a number of years. And I'm, you know, read some stuff of his, and my first book, Building Your Field of Dreams, comes out, and I'm on a book tour, and I speak, get called to speak at the Christian Buddhist conference that's happening in Chicago, when I'm going to be in Chicago doing a book signing anyway. I'm not speaking on the main stage. I'm speaking in a breakout room on transcendentalism, and maybe 50 people in that room with the thousands that are there come and go. And that was a nice event. About 2 months later, randomly, I pick up the phone. It's the office of Tibet calling me, asking me if I'd be willing to come to Dharamsala, India, to take an interview with His Holiness, because he is creating a 7-year project called the Synthesis Project that would bring groups of people together. His goal is to have conversations over a period of time so that people who are innovators on the planet from every section of life, health, medicine, education, science, technology, governance, that the innovators could get together and talk about how to solve the world problems. But I'm told that he knows that there are many different religious diversities that'll be in that room and needs someone to help monitor or facilitate this meeting who has a respect and an honoring for all the religions. And that somebody His Holiness knows has been in that 40-person room where I spoke about transcendentalism.
Wow.
You know, so I got on a jet. I flew to Dharamsala. I went into, what you can see, once you get to Dharamsala, India, you understand why India gave him that land to build his place to live after he's kicked out of Tibet. It's just so mountainous and hilly. But anyway, so I go to his place, they go through security, get in the room, and here he is, and he's got a pot of tea. It was just exactly what I had imagined.
Wow.
Now, the first whole part of that is his interview of me. And then he turns and says, the question is, do you have any question you'd like to ask me? And I get to
ask him. But it's a real moment.
And I get to ask that question. And I go, this is exactly, it worked the way I, there was a time when I actually was walking my little boy into kindergarten.
Yeah.
Feeling right. His warm hand. There was a time when I was sitting, but I lived into it prior, but through rehearsal, visualization, and the feeling of being there, not wanting mm-hmm. to get there. See, you can never get to your dream. You have to come from it.
You'll experience the what it feels like to be striving for as opposed to being in, right?
Having it. You're the person experiencing it. That's a completely different vibration. Because you can, as long as I'm the person trying to get there, I'll keep trying to get there. That's who I am. I got to be the person who's having the experience at least enough so that it begins to organize enough of the energies to actually produce it into form. So here's, you want to know his answer?
Yeah,
of course. I said, how do you do this? How do you do this? I've heard you speak. I've read your books. I can't find one after everything that's been going on with Tibet. I can't find one wavelength of bitterness or revenge or anger in you. And he goes, oh, he says, first, Chinese people don't do this. Chinese government do this. Mm. He says, we all have friends. Friends, easy love, easy forgive. Ah, but we have sacred friends as well. Sacred friends, very, very difficult. Very difficult.
Mm. Mm.
Chinese government, my sacred friend.
Ooh.
But without Chinese government doing exactly what they do, I would never have had to evolve my heart mm-hmm. to be bigger than the pain they bring.
Oof.
And the Tibetans have a practice for that called bodhicitta, which is the practice of compassion, regardless of condition.
Mm.
And he shared some things with me about that. But the idea, of course, was that even in this, there's something that you can find good in. So he evolved his heart that he won the Nobel Prize. I mean, for peace, it's made world impact. I then thought, I want to meet Nelson Mandela next.
Yeah.
I want to ask him, how did you do it? How did you go from being this guy who gets sentenced to life in prison? And not only do you get out after 40 years of almost, he's 27 years. After all of that time at hard labor, not only do you get out before you die, but then you become president of the country who sentenced you to life in prison.
Wow.
Who on our planet does that?
Yeah.
One person,
yeah.
You. How did you do that? What had happened inside of you? And then he shared his journey. But the point of this isn't, oh, Mary got to see the Dalai Lama or Nelson Mandela. It's the system.
Yeah.
What is it that, you know, I would just invite each listener today. What is it that really matters to you, and what would you most love to bring into your world, into your life, into what really matters to you while you're still here?
Yeah.
You can, we can move in that direction. We can help you. And this is what Brendan's program does each and every week. So anyway, I'm just grateful to be
here. What an inspiring story. And if you would share a little bit, about that, you know, you've got Dream Builder Live coming up here in a few weeks as of this recording. And so, if you could just share whatever is relevant to share about that.
Well, I'm grateful, Brendan, that you wanted to use this moment to give an opportunity for any one of your listeners who would like to go further with this, a completely complimentary ticket to Dream Builder Live. And the Dream Builder Live deposit ticket. It's a free ticket with refundable deposit once you attend the event. So you put a deposit down so we hold your seat, but once you attend the event, we give you the deposit back. So it's completely complimentary. It's a three-day event. It's virtually. It's January 27th, 28th, and 29th. And again, you get your deposit back in full once you attend the event. But this is where we train in the art and the science of dream building, actually transforming your life, answering those longings, dissolving the discontents, creating a vision, learning what it means to match that vibration, and then how it is that you implement that, how you actually build it day by day, coming from the result and not from the conditions that seem overwhelming, like they're stopping you, linoleum, no advertising money, and metal chairs, how we move our energy from the things that we think are blocking us and open the door to you actually having the life you love.
Mm. Yeah, what an amazing event. Have you been doing these for, is this
many years,
the first one? Okay, that's what I figured.
No. We've been doing this form, which is turned into the most successful way to help more people in 3 days since 2010.
Yeah.
So 13 years,
What an amazing story you have, what an inspiration you are, and this has been absolutely incredible.
Well, I'm so grateful for the work you do, and thank you for inviting me into it.
Yeah, it's a pleasure and an honor. And I do have one final question for you here today, and it is my cliche closer. And it is this: in 60 seconds or less, what is the meaning of life, according to Mary Morrissey?
I think the meaning of life is that every one of us has a light to shine. And as we find what it is that we're here to be, to shine that light, whether it's raising a child really well as part of it, or all the many ways that love expresses to us, but that we all have a light to shine. And the important thing is we not only shine it into the world, but we let that light bless us as well.
Mm. Yes, I love that. I think of Gandhi says, if you want to find yourself, lose yourself in the service of others. And I always like to add to that, you know, the reason I believe that holds true is because there are no others, right? So shining that light, literally giving to receive. And Thank you for giving today, Mary. It's been a pleasure and an honor. And since we're so close, I look forward to meeting in person. I am visioning. I am. The vision is there. So get your tea ready.
Okay. Awesome.
Thank all of you for tuning in, your beautiful brainwaves and incredible hearts. Until next time, journey well.